brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
The guys in that video room that you build a relationship with are the guys who kind of help you get jobs, because those are the kind of guys in your same age range, and those are the guys who are progressing and developing their careers. And I think those guys in the video room, along with those relationships you build, are the guys that end up helping you out the most as a young coach.
Cameron Black is in his second season as an assistant coach for the Texas Legends, the NBA G League affiliate of the Dallas Mavericks. Cam played his college basketball for Bowling Green State University before joining the University of Akron staff as a graduate assistant. The Ohio native spent two seasons in player development with the Atlanta Hawks and then moved into his first coaching role with the Erie BayHawks. In the 2019-2020 season, Black was an assistant for the Grand Rapids Drive, where he helped coach centers and assisted in two NBA call-ups. Take some notes as you listen to this episode with Cameron Black, assistant coach for the Texas Legends, the NBA G League affiliate of the Dallas Mavericks. Hey, Hoopheads. This January, our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball introduced their all-new CT Plus machine with a 21.5-inch touchscreen that allows players to train offline, build custom drills, compete in multiplayer mode, and view their stats in real time. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on their Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT Plus models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Doc Esslinger, head men's basketball coach at Caltech, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and FastScout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. FastModel also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. FastModel Sports is the best in basketball. The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe's Decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered. Hello, and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Suckle tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by Cameron Black, assistant basketball coach for the Texas Legends of the NBA's G League. Cam, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Hey, how's it going? Appreciate you having me on.
Absolutely. Excited to have you on. Full disclosure, Cam's coming back from a long road trip tonight, and he's been willing to stay up with us. So excited to be able to talk basketball with him and learn a little bit more about him and his career. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about some of your first experiences with the game of basketball.
Yep. So I grew up in a real basketball and kind of sport oriented family. My dad played basketball at Northland High School in Columbus, went on to play at the University of Cumberland in Williamsburg, Kentucky, NAIA school. He came back and went to go teach and coach at Kent Roosevelt High School in Kent, Ohio. Met my mom, who was also a basketball player at Bookville High School in Akron. And they kind of met and had me, and I kind of grew up in the gym. My dad ended up coaching girls basketball, girls track, Same with the boys and boys track and boys basketball as well. So that's kind of where I grew up. And my first kind of steps as a kid were in the gym, seeing all the sports, watching them on TV. And that's kind of where it started at. And from there on, just went to play in different gyms, playing at parks, you know, starting the young AAU teams, travel teams early on, being good on those teams. And then other teams would come and kind of recruit you and want you to play with them. So that's kind of how it started.
More sports than just basketball, or is basketball always the main thing?
Basketball is really the main thing. Played a little bit of football growing up and kind of stopped my freshman year of high school. Ended up hitting a big growth spurt, and I went from like 6'1 to 6'8. And I said, kind of football is not for me. I really only played football because a lot of my friends played. And that during that season, I just wouldn't have anything to do. So that was kind of my release and what I did.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think once you get to a certain size, unless you were going to put on about 120 pounds, right? You're probably not going to be too good as a 6'8 skinny guy on the football field. I think you probably made the right choice going to hoops. When you think about your time growing up with your dad as a coach and being able to have access and get in the gym from the time that you were really young, what are some of your memories of like your dad's teams and maybe his players and just sort of being around that team atmosphere?
My memories of my dad coaching were just being a very defensive oriented coach, making sure that guys and girls played very hard on the defensive end. He knew a little bit of offense, but that really wasn't his thing. He just wanted to make sure the guys and girls in those teams play hard. And probably the biggest thing that I remember from my dad being a coach in that kind of small town is going around and, you know, the guys and girls that play for him to come back to him. And, you know, they stop at the house or we see him around town at the grocery store. And they just thank my dad for being a positive influence and keeping him out of trouble, kind of helping him out with life. So it's one of the reasons why I wanted to be a coach.
When did you know you wanted to be a coach? Was that something that you knew early on, or did it come later, like when you were in college?
Honestly, my grandmother, who passed away, but one of the stories that she would tell all the time is me being, I'm not sure the exact age, but around 5, 6, or 7, you know, out in the front yard playing with kids in the neighborhood. And I would pull out my dad's clipboard and I would draw. she always says that I would take the pen or marker and bang it on the clipboard saying, pay attention, pay attention. So it's kind of like one of those things that was really just in my blood. And I saw it growing up and I really wanted to do it.
Yeah, that's funny. I mean, it's interesting because I think most people come to the coaching profession in one of two ways. They come to it as you described, where it's somebody that from a really young age, maybe they had somebody like you had your dad who influenced them as a mentor and somebody that they looked up to, and they kind of always knew they wanted to be a coach. And then you have the other people who were playing and they're kind of going through their career, and all of a sudden they get done either as a high school player or a college player or a pro player, and they look around, they're like, the game's going to kind of end, and now what do I do? Maybe I want to get into coaching. And so it's always interesting to kind of hear people's journey into the coaching profession, because you have those two sort of distinct tracks, those who have known from the time they were little, and then those who kind of come to it a little bit later after their other experiences as a player in the game are done. And obviously there's a lot of different pathways into coaching, but I think when you have a dad or a parent who's a coach, I think that obviously has a huge influence. When you think back to yourself as a high school player, what do you remember about what you would do in your summers to try to work on your game and get better? What did that look like for you? How'd you balance out playing pickup ball versus working in the gym on your game by yourself, or working with your dad, or just what was your process like?
Yeah, well, my process really, and honestly, it started out in the driveway. Like I would watch an NBA game or a college game that wasn't in season, but a game that was on. I would learn a new move or see a shot that I wanted to work on. The next day, you know, I go out in the driveway, work on that move, work on those shots. We had a little weight set in the garage, so I work on my game, then go in the garage, hit the weights, and then we had a park that was close to the house, so I would go and walk to the park. You know, sometimes in a small town like that, there's nobody at the park. I walk right back and start working on my game again and maybe eat lunch or something like that. Then I go back to the park, then I go play all day, and then I come back. So that was kind of my process, and that kind of process helped me keep getting better, kept me in shape during the week. And then on the weekends during the summer, you're going to play AAU tournaments against better competition. So that was kind of my process, and that's kind of how I turned into a decent player.
What's your favorite memory from playing high school basketball?
Favorite memory, my senior year, we lost one of a great player by the name of Andre Polk. And then it was kind of my team that senior year. And the previous year, we lost in the district final at the buzzer to Barberton. So the next year, it was my opportunity kind of with my team. Ended up getting to the district final, or the game before the district final. We were playing against a pretty good team in Twinsburg, who was ranked top 25 in Cleveland. They had a recruit by the name of John Harris, who was going to Miami, Ohio, another kind of 6'8 guy. And that was kind of the big matchup for me. And then the college coach the college coach who I played for, Lewis Orr, was also in attendance for that game, and ended up playing pretty well. We won, and that game took us to the district final. So just playing that game, played pretty well in a good environment and tournament. A lot of people didn't think that we'd be there. Playing against a good recruit and then John Harris, and then winning that game was probably my best memory. That next game, we also lost in the district final at the buzzer to Akron East. So just playing in that game, hitting two game-winning free throws in that game is probably my best memory from high school.
I think high school, when you look back, it's fun to think about. I think the environments are so important. When you get to play in front of a big crowd, obviously, once you get to the districts here in the state of Ohio, now you start to get a lot more people coming to those games, and certainly the environments in those games are conducive to making for great memories. You and I talked a little bit before that Cam went to Bowling Green State University in the MAC, and I went a long, long, long time ago, played at Kent, and obviously Cam grew up in Kent, Ohio. And so talk a little bit about your recruitment, how you ended up at Bowling Green, and just a little bit about, you know, you said you had a little personal vendetta when you come back and play against Ken at the MAC Center.
Yep. So I grew up for the most part playing on kind of local AAU teams. And as I kept working on my game and getting better, people started to hear about me. And there was a King James Shooting Stars AAU team that lost to center and Zach Price, who I think he went to St. Edward's in Cleveland, but he got hurt and they were looking for a big guy. And they ended up calling me. So I went out for the first tournament and played pretty well. I was a guy who people didn't know about, you know what I mean? Played against a Boo Williams team that had James McAdoo on that team. I'm not saying that I locked them up at all, but I played pretty well. And the next Monday when I got back from school, my pitcher was on Rivals. And that was kind of a big thing back then. And that's kind of where my recruitment kind of took off, playing with a better team with more exposure. And then my first offer actually came from Ashland University, which was a Division II school in Ohio. The next one came from Youngstown State. If anybody from Ohio knows anything about Youngstown State, that's not a kind of place that you really want to go play. You'd rather go somewhere else. And at the AAU National Tournament in Florida, my parents got a call from Coach Lewis Orr. He was actually watching me on the court and ended up offering me a scholarship on the phone. So that's kind of how that happened.
Was it a hard decision or was it an easy decision?
For me, like an under-recruited guy, like it was an easy decision because you have a guy that coaching at Bowling Green who's won championships, who's played in the NBA. It was a kind of – Bowling Green is kind of like Kent, a small town as well, but it was also away from home, so it gave me a chance to kind of grow up and do my own thing. And I really enjoyed the campus and everything like that. So it was a pretty easy decision for me.
When you think back to that time, what advice was your dad giving you? What kind of conversations were you guys having as the process was playing out? Maybe as you talked about the fact that maybe you were a little bit under-recruited and maybe you were looking around going, hey, I played against this guy or I played against that guy and I see they're going to play here or going to play there. Just what do you remember about the conversations you were having with your father during that time?
During that time, I think there were guys who were recruited by a lot of schools and kind of know what they wanted to do. Me being under-recruited, it was almost kind of like you want to take the first thing that you get almost because one of those things where I wasn't expected, like growing up, to go play D1, you know what I mean? I kind of worked my way to that level and kind of developed late. So it was one of those things where I kind of turned down Youngstown State but ended up finding a good school with a good coach and kind of went with that decision.
What'd you like about Coach Orr right from the beginning?
Coach Orr was very personable. One thing that kind of hit with my family was he was a religious man, a man of God, somebody who we all knew would be a great father figure being away from home. It really wasn't a basketball decision. It was more of a decision based off of who my family trusted and who I trusted as a man.
When you got there, what were the adjustments like, both on the court and in terms of going to school and just being in a different environment?
Yeah, the big adjustments on the court were, I think every level that you go up, it's the speed of the game, more athletic players. For me, being a kind of skinny guy coming out of high school, I think I was 6'10", about 230-ish. And then you're going up against guys who are, you know, the same size, but they're 260 and 270. And I came in at 18 years old and ended up kind of playing a lot my first year and starting. And those guys I started playing against were 22, 23 years old. So I really had to get adjusted to the speed of the game and also the strength from the other players as well.
How about in terms of the practices? You talked a little bit about your high school experience. And then obviously when you go and you step up and you get into the practice environment at college, just what was that piece of it like for you day to day, comparing just your experience as a college player going to practice every day versus a high school player going to practice every day?
With my ability at the high school level in practice, there wasn't a lot of competition, you know what I mean? But once you step up to the college Division I level, mid-majors, there's really competition every single day, and you can't really take days off, you know what I mean? So if you take a day off, you're going to get dunked on. If you're late in help, you're going to get dunked on, you know? That's kind of how it goes. You have to be ready to play every day. And in the off season, the kind of adjustment was, like, we had a lot of track stuff, running the steps, running the stairs, like weight rooms and open gym for a couple hours, then individual player development, you know what I mean? So it was kind of structured in that kind of – more structured in that sense because we had more time and more people devoted to the program.
When you get to school, are you still thinking about – as you decide what you're going to major in and where you, what direction you want to go, are you still thinking coaching is the direction that you want to go at this point, or are you thinking something else?
I think the coaching / sports administration route, as well, I was thinking about coaching was always on my mind, you know, growing up and then in high school, but I wasn't sure how I'd be able to make money from coaching. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It's kind of the thought process there.
When you're playing, I think this is one of the things that is interesting too. If you're thinking about coaching, were you in any way, not only as you're thinking about yourself as a player and worrying about playing your best and competing and doing all the things that are required of a Division I basketball player, but are you thinking about and watching the coaching staff at all and sort of watching what they do and thinking about how that could impact you as a coach? Or were you more focused on, hey, I'm a player, and then the coaching thing was just kind of in the back of your mind?
I think probably the second part. I was focused on trying to be the best player I could be, but also there's a lot of downtime that comes along with college basketball. Obviously, you have class and all that stuff, but there's certain moments where after practice you may go in the coach's office, and that's where I kind of talked to Coach Orr and also another coach by the name of Coach Lewis Twigg about, like, coaching, how to get into it and what their kind of story was and how their life has gone in the coaching atmosphere.
Do you remember any of the advice they gave you?
Kind of funny. Coach Orr said, don't do it.
He's probably not the first one to say that.
Not the first one. I didn't listen to that. But Coach Lewis Twigg was really a guy who didn't necessarily play in college, but came up as a manager and things like that. And he kind of gave me advice along the way. And some of the best advice he kind of gave me was first of all, just be a good person so nobody has anything bad to say about you, but as well as kind of let people know what you want to do. And that's kind of how I got into this spot, just letting him know what I wanted to do. And when I got done playing, the opportunity kind of came, kind of jumping steps a little bit here, but kind of through him and building that relationship and letting him know that I wanted to coach, that's kind of how I got to the Hawks. So,
all right. Before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about your playing career. What's your favorite? I asked you what your favorite high school memory was. What's your favorite memory from playing at BG?
Ooh, favorite memory. Let's go back to kind of what we talked about earlier. Came to Kent State my senior year and just had a really good game. Like I said, being a kind of under-recruited guy, Kent State was right in our backyard. I grew up 5-10 minutes away. Didn't receive the attention that I wanted from that school. And then I always had a little vengeance, wanted to get some revenge. I never really had a good game. There was some games I was hurt, games I got in foul trouble. But my senior year at Kent, I ended up having a good game, had about 18 points and like 9 or 10 rebounds and a few blocks. And we actually ended up kind of losing that game. But just having a good game at that place, that's one of my favorite memories.
Little personal vendetta. What was your favorite place to play in the MAC? Did you have a favorite arena you liked?
Ooh, good question. Akron. Akron always had great teams, great fans. I mean, the music was loud and also was close to home as well. So I had a lot of fans and family and friends come to see that game, those games. So that was a great, great experience.
What about the place you least like to play?
Probably like a Ball State.
Long bus trip.
Ball State, Northern Illinois, some of those games. Like you said, long trip and not a lot of fans and had to go out in cold weather during those times in, you know, January, February. Those are probably the trips that I didn't like the most.
I always hated playing at Miami, the dark. Yeah. I always felt like it was dark there whenever we played. I'm like, man, how do they even see in here, man? It's crazy.
Yep, Miami, Ohio is like it's kind of like a theater where they perform. Yep. It's dark. Yep.
Yeah, that was a different experience. I never had much luck down there, so I was always glad to get out of Miami whenever I could. All right, so when you get done with your playing career, and you've got some advice from your coaching staff, and they're talking to you, and you get an opportunity to go and be a graduate assistant at the University of Akron, talk about how that comes to pass.
Coming out of college, I kind of wasn't sure if I know I wanted to coach, but I wasn't sure if I wanted to go and play first. So I ended up signing an agent, ended up having an offer to go to Luxembourg. Wasn't a whole lot of money. And I kind of joked around with my friends and said, man, I could make this amount of money working at McDonald's. You know?
And McDonald's would probably actually pay you.
They have more benefits and all that.
Yeah.
I knew if I played overtime, I may be able to, you know, get better contracts and make more money. But also had a lot of injuries at Bowling Green. I had a stress fracture in my tibia. I had a partially torn patella tendon in my other knee. So I didn't want to risk those opportunities. And I grew up in a family who really valued education. My mom was like a top 10 student in high school class, went on to nursing. And those are kind of one of the things that they stressed. So I knew that if I go to Akron to be a GA, I can get my education for free and then start coaching as well.
When you get to Akron and you sort of step behind the curtain as a coach, you've been a player for your entire life and obviously your dad coached, so you had some idea of what the life of a coach was like. But what do you remember about that first experience coaching in terms of maybe something that was surprising to you that you're like, man, I didn't realize coaches spent so much time doing this?
Yep. The biggest thing at that level was I didn't know how much time they spent recruiting. Like as a high school athlete, you know, you're getting a lot of calls from different schools, but you don't notice that coach who called you also probably called, you know, 10, 15, 20 or more other kids that day. So that's one of the things that took a lot of time. Also, just the scouting process. You don't know how much, obviously now too, but you don't know how much time the coaches spend like watching games and putting edits together and kind of getting the team prepared to play. So those are kind of things that kind of surprised me the most.
Was there a coach on the staff that took you under their wing and sort of became a mentor to you while you were there?
Yep. Two coaches on that staff. The first one, Terry Wygant, is kind of the reason why I actually went to Akron. He kind of recruited me to Akron. But when I would go from Bowling Green back home in the summer, my mom worked in Akron, so sometimes I pop in and I see Coach Wygant, and I also, same thing, kind of let him know that I wanted to coach. So by the time I got done, he was the one who kind of reached out to me and kind of got me into it. And the other one was Charles Thomas. Spent a lot of time with him going to lunches and things like that, and he just kind of teach me the rules of the game and how to recruit and things like that. So those are the two guys for me.
I spent a lot of time on the court against Charles when he was at Eastern and I was at Kent. So we battled each other for 2 years. I think he was a year ahead of me. So when I was a sophomore, by the time I was playing, I didn't play much as a freshman, but as a sophomore and a junior, the Thomas twins were tough to deal with, man. They were really good players. And obviously they're both still in the game and in the coaching profession today. So that's a, That's a good mentor. That's a good person to have on your side without question.
Yep.
So when you look at your time there and you start thinking about your career path, did you have in mind, because obviously your dad's a high school coach, now you're coaching at the college level, and eventually where you are now, you're coaching at the pro level. What were you thinking about in terms of what you thought your career path would be in the coaching profession at the time you were at Akron? Were you thinking, hey, I really love this college coaching and I'd like to stay here? Were you thinking about going to the pros at some point? Were you thinking about high school coaching? Just where was your mindset at while you were at Akron?
My mindset was kind of watching my dad for years. I loved the fact that he was a coach and could do his thing on the floor, but also wasn't necessarily a fan of him having to teach all day. And I kind of knew that taking the college route, I can get the coaching and kind of do that full time and not really have to go the teaching route. And as far as the pros, honestly, coaching in the pros is something that never crossed my mind, like literally never. And it just one day just kind of happened. So,
well, tell us about it. How does that happen? How do you get to your next stop is with the Atlanta Hawks? So how does that opportunity get in front of you?
Yep. So I talked about Coach Lewis Twigg, assistant at Bowling Green before. Same thing, just being a good guy to him when some of the guys on our team weren't, kind of picking his brain, letting him know that I wanted to coach. And one day got a call from him that the Hawks were looking for a big guy who can come in and play a little bit and do some video. Ended up sending my resume in, got a call back and had a phone interview with Charles Lee, who is currently assistant with Milwaukee Bucks. Also had a phone interview with Taylor Jenkins, who is now head coach with the Memphis Grizzlies. Did good with those interviews, kind of showed them that I was a good person. I knew what I was talking about the game, and they ended up flying me down for an interview. At that interview, I wasn't sure if it was going to be, you know, like one of those kind of sit down things on the court, and it ended up being pretty much all on the court. They put me to the test. They put me in pick and roll defense, guarding guys like Dennis Schroeder and Jeff Teague in pick and roll. I had to guard Paul Millsap and Al Horford and those guys in the post, and really had to kind of hold my own as best I could during their workouts. Making sure I was sprinting to all the loose balls and everything like that. And everything went pretty well. Uber back to the airport, got a call that I got the job. So went from being at Akron about to start that second season, going with my grad assistant thing, and going straight to Atlanta. So that's kind of how it happened.
Did you expect that interview to be on the floor? I mean, was that something that they warned you, like, hey, in advance, like, you got to be ready to step out on the floor and play, because that's a big piece of what this job's going to entail?
There was no discussion of that. There was.
Did you show up in a suit?
Honestly, I did. Yeah, I showed up in a suit. and they actually appreciated and they liked that I came looking like a professional. And then they took me right to the equipment room. So what size shirt you wear? What size?
That's funny.
You know, yep, and had to go play.
So once you're hired on and you get there, and are you looking around going, wow, I'm in the NBA. Now, obviously you're at a entry level position, but still you're working with NBA players. You're working with NBA coaches. Just what was your feeling as you're sitting there in the office or you're on the court and you're working with these pro guys? Just obviously you said earlier that it wasn't expected. You were never thinking about coaching at the pro level. So what was your initial reaction? How are you feeling as you started that job?
Yeah, well, my initial reaction kind of will go back to that interview. It's kind of before the season starts. It's not training camp time yet, and you don't really expect those guys to be in there. And when I put that shirt and the shorts on, I walk in the gym, I'm like, you know, I literally was just playing with my friends 2K and using the Hawks last week, and now for the first time, I get to see these guys in person. And it's kind of a starstruck kind of thing, but you have to hold it in because you don't want those guys to know that you're
right. Yeah.
Just that first experience being with the team in training camp is just amazing, really. I mean, it's kind of hard to describe as, you know, like I talked about earlier, a guy from a sports family who loves basketball, and all of a sudden you're like at the NBA level and getting to see all these great coaches and players. It's kind of, it's almost indescribable.
Was there something that was unexpected or something that went on during whether NBA training camp, NBA practices, were there things that you watched that you were surprised that were happening in an NBA practice, whether that's just the way they went about it, whether that was something specific that they worked on or talked about, or the structure of practices? What were your first impressions?
My first impression was that, and I called my dad and told him this too, basketball is basketball. Whether that's at the pro level with the Hawks or whether that's on an elementary school team, it's like shell defense is shell defense. You know what I mean? I was kind of surprised that, at least to start, everything was, you know, the fundamentals and the basics. It was having a stick hand up and low man help and things of that nature. The same things that we kind of, as kids, take for granted. That's the exact same thing that the pros are doing. You know what I mean? I think that's one kind of thing that gets lost in all this.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, obviously you can get into the specifics and the X's and O's and all those things, but ultimately it really does come down to there's some basic movements, some basic actions that are universal to basketball. And again, ultimately, right, you got to be able to execute what it is that you do, and you got to do it full speed. You got to do it hard, and you got to be able to compete. And if you can do that, no matter what the level of basketball, chances are you're going to have some success. While you were there, was there a guy player-wise that you kind of connected with? Was there somebody that you would say, hey, I'm still in touch with this guy, or somebody that you felt like you built a pretty good relationship with?
Yep. That guy for me would be Dennis Schroeder. As a young guy going there, I'm 22, he's 22-ish, 23, and just being in the gym, I actually met him one of my first days down there. Just in the gym, kind of late, didn't know what to do, didn't know anybody in Atlanta. And he ended up coming in wanting to shoot. And we shot during the workout. I didn't necessarily work him out or anything, just kind of worked hard and had played some music for him. And that's how we kind of built a relationship from there.
Yeah, I think being able to get in the gym and get shots up, I've talked to a number of different coaches on the podcast, Cam, that have talked about how, hey, I was a low man on the totem pole as a coach, and I just went in and I started working with guys and just rebounded for them. And not necessarily, like you said, not necessarily working them out, but just being there, hey, I'll rebound for you. And then slowly, again, you develop that relationship. You start to build trust with the player. And then before you know it, you've got that type of relationship where you can really help that player to continue to improve and get better. What were some of your responsibilities when you weren't out there on the practice floor trying to help players develop in that way?
Some of my responsibilities off the floor was front office video. So coming in, they said they would teach me how to do all the video using Sports Code, different programs. So one of my first responsibilities was doing front office video. You know, as a game, you watch an international game, it's probably 3 hours long. And all I would do is kind of cut one to the game. So the front office guys, Wes Wilcox was GM that time, not send him games that will go from 3 hours to, you know, 50 minutes. And that's kind of where it started from there, doing the ones and twos. And then after that, when the season kind of gets rolling around, each intern has different coaches they work with on scouts. So then I go from kind of doing ones and twos to getting plays and play calls and shots and things of that nature and helping that coach put a scout together. Those are the kind of biggest things that you do off the court. And that's something that I've never kind of did or heard of, but that's something that's really time consuming for people kind of don't understand. When you end up coding 3, 4, 5 games a day, we're on the court working hard and playing and all that stuff. But once you're off the court, you're right back in the video room, and there's 4 or 5 guys in there just kind of sitting there coaching games all day. And that's kind of how you hear about those relationships getting built in that video room.
How much did you pick up in terms of your knowledge of X's and O's? Because I've talked to a couple other different guys who worked in the video rooms in the NBA, and they've talked about how just sitting down and having to watch the sheer volume of film that you guys watch in those scenarios, that they felt like they came away from that just with a tremendous gain in their knowledge of the X's and O's of the game. Do you feel like that was what happened for you as well?
The interesting thing about that is when you're scouting a team, you're learning about each individual player, and you have to kind of figure out how they play, what moves they use, and their tendencies. Then you move on to the offensive portion. You basically go and learn every team in the league's offense. You know what I mean? You're going through what they're doing in transition, their early offense, their sets, side out, baseline out, in the game plays. And those are kind of things that Honestly, in the video room, we're kind of coding at a fast pace. Sometimes it's 1.5, 2, and 3 speed, but you end up kind of just watching so much film that you kind of just start to pick up things. And as a somebody who wants to coach, you're kind of like going through it like, you know, I like that play, or I like the offense, or this player is doing this. And that kind of builds your kind of, I don't know the right word, but it kind of builds your coaching catalog. And those are kind of things that you use for yourself.
United Basketball Plus is your doorway to all things basketball. If you desire to go further, faster as a coach and leader, if you want to maximize your team's potential, or if you simply just want to be a student of basketball, United Basketball Plus is the resource to take you to the next level in your basketball journey. As a member, you will have access to some of the greatest minds in basketball today. The in-depth videos provided by these coaches and basketball experts will help make difficult concepts simple to understand and teach. With your membership, you will have access to video playbooks, sports psychology, fast model playbooks, skill development, speed agility, and various other United Basketball Clinic videos. Your annual membership also includes access to our 2021 United Basketball Clinics, as well as discounts to attend future basketball clinics. The best way to find out all we have to offer is to visit us at unitedbasketballplus.com.
Did you have a way, or do you have a way currently of sort of compiling all the things that you're learning? In other words, do you have the old fashioned way would be you'd have the 3-ring binder or the notebooks? And obviously the more modern way, you've got things saved on Google Drive, but just what's a process you have for as you're learning as a coach, as you're picking up things, as you're taking notes, as you're seeing a video or a play that you like, how are you compiling all that into sort of your database so that you can have that at your fingertips, at your disposal as you continue on in your career? What's your method for kind of cataloging all the things that you've learned in your coaching time?
Yeah, there's two ways. One would be using the program we use in the NBA. It's called Sports Code, and you can actually create a database. And if there's a play or something that I like, I'll kind of send that to my own database, which I kind of carry and build over the years. And then the second one is you kind of just have to remember.
Yeah.
When you remember those things, now I get in coaching meetings with our team with the legends, and we may want to talk about how to guard a different action and what to run. And it's kind of one of those things where I remember what I saw, or I remember what a coach with the Hawks may have said, or something like that. And you kind of have to bring those things to the forefront, to the table. And those things end up helping you look good as a coach.
What were the relationships that you built with the Hawks that are guys that you could still reach out to today that have sort of helped you advance in your career? Who were some of the people on the staff that you developed a close relationship with?
Yep, it's kind of interesting at that level. I love the coach. Bud is a great guy to look up to, but you know, in those situations, when you're the low man on the totem pole, Coach Bud is not coming up to you every day. that goes to a lot of the assistants too. They have things going on. They have families. They have scouts. And you're kind of there to do the work and help them out, and then they're going home to their family. The guys in that video room that you build a relationship with, and with that I built relationships with, are the guys who kind of help you get jobs, because those are the kind of guys in your same age range, and those are the guys who are progressing and developing their careers. And I think those guys in the video room, along with those relationships you build, are the guys that end up helping you out the most as a young coach.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it makes a ton of sense, right? Because those are the guys you're sitting in that room with all the time. And as you get older, I think this is one of the things that I learned, and not just in coaching, but in life. When you're 22, 23, 24, 25, you know lots of people and you got lots of friends, but most of those friends and people that you know, they don't really have much power. They're not really in positions where they can make anything happen for a lot of times for themselves, but certainly not for somebody else. And then you realize as time goes on and those people continue to advance in their career, that eventually that network that you've built of contemporaries, of peers when you're 22, 23, 24, 25, that makes a huge difference in terms of being able to network and being able to get jobs and be able to be aware of what's out there because of that network that you built when you were younger. I think that's a really important consideration when you think about the direction that you want to go in your career. Did that have anything to do with the opportunity that you got next, which was with the Erie BayHawks?
So that opportunity came about. So Malik Rose worked in the front office with the Hawks. Malik is somebody who is very personable, but also with the Hawks, we would play as a staff on off days and before games. And me and Malik always kind of ended up having to guard each other. Malik is obviously played in the NBA and all that, but he was a little bit older. And he was a guy who I was able to bump a little bit and show that I could play. And we kind of developed a relationship from there. And also with him working in the front office, he wanted to kind of learn how to use sports code and become a better guy in the front office by being able to kind of code and watch his own video. And that's kind of one of the things that I kind of sat down with and ended up showing him. So that offseason, he ended up getting a GM, general manager job with the Erie Bayhawks, and basically told me to come on and join him.
How did your role change and expand when you go from being in the video room and on-court player development with the Hawks to your role when you get to the Bayhawks? Now I'm assuming that you're doing more of the actual what most people would think of as coaching. So just tell us a little bit about your day-to-day role there in Erie.
Yeah, well, going back to the Hawks, you know, on the court, helping with all those player development workouts, whether it was a guard or a big, playing with those guys on the off days, like we played 3-on-3 full court with 12-second shot clocks, you know, so getting that experience and then helping out with practice and drills and then going back to that video room and just coding up games and helping guys with scouts, that kind of leads you into the next job, which is you're the guy running the 3-on-3 workouts, and you're kind of helping guys get and stay in shape. You're the guy who's running the player development workouts with the bigs and things like that. And then I actually had to code my own games in Erie, kind of do both because the G Leagues have such a small staff, but ended up coding my own games and then developing my own scout reports. So it was a great experience kind of being able to go from you're with the Hawks and you're the help, but then you go to the G League and now it's really on you to do a good job developing players and developing scouts.
So at this point now, you're in your second professional basketball coaching position. Are you pretty set that that's the direction that you want to continue to go? Are you still thinking that, hey, maybe at some point I'll go back and think about college? Or are you just kind of in the moment and just saying, hey, I try to do the best job I can here, and then we'll kind of let the chips fall where they may?
Yeah, I was kind of set in that moment, kind of focused on what I was doing. But also, I kept all options open. You know, I wasn't opposed to potentially going back to college, and also wasn't opposed to a different G League team or a higher role on G League team or getting back to the NBA. Just kind of being in the moment and learning and kind of appreciating the opportunity.
What do you think as you look at these first couple experiences at Akron, at Atlanta, and then with Erie, obviously three different levels of the game of basketball and sort of three different roles in each of those different organizations? What were some of the things that you feel like you learned in those first three experiences that continue to benefit you today in your current role with the Legends?
Things that I learned in my coaching career at that point that helped me that I apply now. One is being a good person, because you never know who can help recommend you for a job or who have something good or bad to say about you. The next biggest thing would be developing a relationship with your players. I really learned that from Darvin Ham. I've seen him many a times when guys are going through bad times on the court or they're frustrated about playing time and things like that. I watched Darvin Ham sit in that corner and talk to that player and end up building a relationship that can help get that player back on the right track. So that's kind of one of the things I use now with the Legends. When I sit down with the guy and watch film, we just don't talk about, you know, the play and what they could have done better. You have to check in on how they're doing as a person, and that kind of helps out on the court as well.
Yeah, I think building that relationship and being able to talk to guys, and I know that's one of the things that has sort of been a theme, honestly, Cam, that I've run through the podcast, is coaches talking about just being able to build that relationship, which one allows you to build trust with the player so that you can help them on the basketball court. But then, as you talked about, you got to get to know them and understand kind of what makes them tick. And then not only are you helping them on the court, but you're also helping them hopefully off the court to become a better person, to have a more successful career, and ultimately get to the goal of where they want to go, the level that you're coaching now and when you were at the Bayhawks, or we're going to talk about your experience with the Grand Rapids Drive as well. Those guys all obviously are hoping that they can make it to the NBA someday, and they're all striving to get there. And so I think your role as a coach, if you can build that relationship, build that trust, and then now, boom, you can try to help those guys to continue to improve and hopefully help them to be able to reach their goal of –
getting to the NBA at some point, or at least being able to move up. And who knows, maybe they get an opportunity if they don't make the NBA. Maybe they get the opportunity to go to Europe and make some more money, or they just continue to grind away in the G League and see if they can't maximize what it is that they have. And I think your role as a coach, obviously, is to help them to be able to do that and reach their goals. After that year at Erie, and you go to the Grand Rapids Drive, what was that like? Why make the change? And maybe compare and contrast the two jobs in terms of, you know, the organization and just what your role was.
Yep. So it didn't happen as smoothly as you just said.
It never does, right?
Yep. So after that season with the BayHawks, that's when Coach Bud went to Milwaukee. He ended up taking our head coach with him. And then all the assistants underneath him didn't have jobs. So I kind of went throughout that summer looking for a job and actually didn't find one. So I moved back home and I figured I only spent that one season in Akron. So I figured I'd finish up my master's. I started substitute teaching back at Kent Roosevelt and the schools I came up in. And also I was assistant coach at Coventry High School, helping out a friend who was previously a grad assistant in Akron with me. So I kind of spent that season helping those kids out and working on my master's and substitute teaching as well. And at that point, I wasn't sure if, you know, this was going to kind of, if that was going to be the route, or would I make it back to the pros or college. So it was kind of some indecision there, but that's what I did for that year. And after that season, I actually applied for some high school jobs in the area and didn't get the head coaching job. And I figured with my professional experience in college and playing, I thought that, honestly, that it would be easy to do. some feedback that I heard from some athletic directors for, you know, if you take this job, what are you going to do when the Lakers call? And it's like, how do I answer that question?
Right, yeah, exactly. There's no good answer there.
Yep. So went through that process and nothing happened. I actually got with Matt Futch, who played at Akron, who was coaching at Buchtel, and was just moving on to CVCA. I was going to help him out that next year. But once again, relationships. So there was a guy in an assistant coaching program in the NBA where the NBA kind of places former players with G League teams to get them coaching experience. And the guy who they placed in Erie was Courtney Alexander. Great college player, actually led the nation in scoring back in his years and played in the NBA as well. We ended up helping him out, kind of learning sports code, learning how to do scouts. And we really built like a brotherly relationship. He's like a big brother to me. And he ended up going to Grand Rapids the season that I didn't coach. And he developed a relationship with Donnie Tindall, who was assistant coach there. Donnie's former college coach. That next season, Donnie got the head coaching job and brought Courtney along with him. And then when they were putting their staff together, Courtney said that, you know, he knows me. He knows that my IQ for the game. And thinks that I could help the bigs out there. And that's how I got that job in Grand Rapids.
When you look at these different organizations that you've worked with, obviously the Hawks on a completely different level, but the three organizations that you've been with in terms of Erie, Grand Rapids, and now the Legends, would you say that all those organizations, are they similar in terms of the way they go about conducting their business, or were there big differences in sort of the way that those organizations were put together?
I think they're pretty similar. Obviously, in the NBA, there's a lot more resources, but in the G League, it's pretty much the same setup. You have one strength coach, you have one trainer, one head coach, and you have about three assistants in both places, in Erie and in Grand Rapids. Really not a permanent place to practice. We practice at different colleges. It's just kind of a G League thing and the nature of the league. You just kind of have to get things done. And that's why being in Texas with the Legends is such a great thing. We practice in a state-of-the-art facility, great crowds, great fans in the Comerica Center. So pretty much in that G League, most things are the same. The only difference is how the coach and GM kind of run things. In Erie, great coach by Josh Longstaff, was actually with the Bulls now. He came from different video rooms in the NBA, and he worked under Bud and kind of learned his system and kind of put that out into his teams. And then in Grand Rapids, you have a coach in Donnie Tindall who didn't coach in the pros for long. He's a longtime college coach. So I kind of got to see two different ways of going about things.
And then talk a little bit about the Legends. How's that organized? And just what's that coaching staff? What's your relationship like with the other coaches?
I have great relationships with the coaches on this staff. Obviously, Nelson Taroba recommended me to be on this podcast. Being with Nelson is just learning a real, we like to call it an old ball coach, somebody who really knows the game, and like somebody who's also a great mentor. A lot of times I get done with my scouts with this team, you know, you're going through the personnel through the video and the sets and all that stuff, and then you're going on the court, walking through the plays and things of that nature. And as soon as I'm done with that scout, I go over to Nelson and say, you know, how was that? You know, sometimes I tell him, you know, that was good. Sometimes you say, that was good, but maybe you should say which player is coming off of that screen and things like that, or the matchup. So just on this staff, we have a great staff, but just it's important to keep learning. It's important to not think you're too good to be coached. Those are the biggest things that go on with this staff.
When you guys are together, and I know you just came off a road trip, but when you guys are playing and it's in season, how much time do you guys spend practicing during the season? And then what's a typical day like? I know there's not a typical day, but how much time are you spending together with the staff, meeting, going over things, watching film? And then how much time during the season do you guys get to practice? Because obviously in the NBA, there's very limited practice time once the season starts. Just I'm curious as to how it works in the G League.
Yeah, in the G League, it's kind of similar to the NBA, except for the less games. So we'll get into pockets in the season where, you know, we're playing back-to-back games, and we'll have three or four games in 1 week, and we may not practice. And there's sometimes where, you know, we may have one game in a week. So during those times where we play a bunch of games, it's more film-based stuff, and we meet as a staff. And as assistant coaches, we go out to lunch with our laptops open, and people think we're crazy, and we're working on, you know, scouts and things like that in the airport. And then during times where we only have maybe one game in a week, a typical day would be like a coach's meeting in the morning, followed by our pre-practice work. Guys are in groups by themselves or twos for 20 to 30 minutes apiece, and we're kind of going through things they need to do to get better and putting them through workouts. Then we're going through practice. And after practice, there may or may not be a meeting, but one of the differences between college and the pros is after your practice in college, you know, you have to make sure guys are going to class and you're doing check-ins and recruiting and things of that nature. But in the G League, I kind of like the fact that after practice, we can kind of just go home and work from home and get our stuff done. So those are kind of differences.
How do you go about building the culture on a team in the G League where you have guys that are coming in and out? You talked a little bit about how on the road trip that you guys were on, that you had seven or eight guys that were healthy and that could play. And so there's lots of challenges that go on that maybe you don't have those same challenges at the college level or at the NBA level. So how do you build a culture within your team? What does that look like from a coaching perspective?
In my opinion, you have to build just a culture of work. You have to build a culture with, first of all, it starts with good people and a good staff. You have to have people on your staff that people want to work with. And then during that practice, you really crank up the music, and you have guys who know what they're doing on the court, and you're trying to just get to work. And one of the biggest things that goes on with the culture is just kind of the conversations that you have with your team in this league. This league is different than a lot of leagues. You kind of have to remind these guys on a weekly or bi-weekly basis that, you know, we're here to work. You're not going to get to the NBA by scoring 40 points a game. These guys are looking for players who can defend and make an open shot. And that's basically what it comes down to. So that's kind of how we talk to the guys on a day-to-day basis. And I have to show guys that we know what we're doing as a staff. You have to prove yourself that as a coach, that you know what you're doing. You can really help those guys get better. And that happens by, you know, on the court and then showing them film that, you can just help those guys get better. That's really what the G League player is concerned about. The G League isn't necessarily about who wins the most games. Obviously, everybody wants to win, but it comes down to how you're developing the guys.
It's interesting because when you think about player development, you think about typically, I think most people look at it and say, okay, I got to develop my all-around game. I got to be able to do this. I got to be able to do that. But the reality is that most of the guys who are in the G League, if they're going to make it to the NBA at all, they're going to make it, as you said, probably as a role player, as a guy, hey, you got to be able to play defense. You got to be able to knock down open threes. In today's game, if you can do those two things, there's probably a role for you. And yet at the same time, I'm sure guys, as you said, the mentality is, hey, I got to show the full array of what my talents are. And yet the reality is once they get to the league, there's only a few guys, maybe one guy, maybe two on each team that kind of gets free reign to have the ball in their hands and make decisions and do all the things that anybody who grew up playing the game would love to be able to do. But the reality is most of the guys are just role players. So how do you convince a player? How do you talk to a player? How do you communicate to players that, hey, you got to get really good at these things and maybe tamp down the idea of I got to really develop my all-around game? It's like you got to get good at the things that you're going to actually do in a game, especially if you want to make it to the league. Just what are those conversations like?
Those conversations, they aren't always easy, but I think when a team like us, the Legends, when we look at the big team and the Dallas Mavericks, especially coming from a big's perspective, I mean, those guys are playing with one of the best players in the league in Luka. And if you look around at that group that's on the floor with him, like the bigs aren't creating shots off the dribble. They're not posting up. They're literally playing in a role with Luka. They're setting screens, rolling to the rim, and getting out the way. And if you get your chance at the next level, you're not going to have posts up, things like that. You're going to set a screen for Luka. You're going to roll, and you're going to get out the way. If you're a guard, the same thing kind of applies. You're going to run your set, and you're going to get Luka the ball, and you're going to get out the way and wait for a shot. And that's kind of it kind of sounds crazy, but I mean, that's what it is when you're playing with great players. And every team has their star kind of top one, two, or three players, and everybody else is basically playing their role on the defensive end, trying to get stops. On the offensive end, you're getting out the way and you're waiting on the ball for a good shot.
Yeah, I know we talked to Mike Procopio on the podcast, I don't know, probably 2 years ago or so. And I know he was with the Mavs for a long time as player development, but he would talk to us about there's so many guys that end up coming to the league and they just don't understand that you got to just do what your coaching staff wants you to do. And you may not necessarily like it. You may think that you can do more, but ultimately there's only 30 to 45 guys in the league that kind of get the free reign to do what they do. And obviously if you're playing on a team with Luka, and we know that his usage rate is historically high, you better be able to play off that guy and do the things that the team needs you to do. And so I just think as a player, it sort of goes against all your natural instincts that your whole life you've been probably the best player on your team. Now all of a sudden you get to the G League, you want to be able to show, hey, these are all the things that I could do. But the reality is, if you're going to make it at the next level, you probably just have to focus on being a role player. And it just seems like for a guy who's in the league, are in the G League, it has to be, I don't want to say confusing, but just I would think it takes a lot of conversation to get that message across of like, hey, look, here's a guy who made it. Here's a guy who was at this level. Now, look, he's playing in the NBA. Look what he gets to do versus, you know, what he might have done when he was a college player or what he might have done when he was a high school player. It completely changes because you have to play a role, as you said. I think that's just got to be one of those things that, as a coach at that level, I think you said it really well when you said, hey, we got to just make guys better and help them to understand what it is that they're trying to do. So I think when you do that and you're doing it a little bit on the floor and you're doing it a little bit off the floor and you're having those conversations, you're trying to work with players. And at the same time, you're trying to win games. It feels like trying to build that culture and making sure that everybody's together. That to me seems like it still has to be challenging to get guys to play together on a day-to-day basis and figuring out what those conversations look like and how you can get guys to buy in. So when you think about that piece of it, when you think about getting guys to buy into the team concept and yet still try to play together, what does that look like on the practice floor when you're trying to get guys to keep the ball moving and sort of play their role? How do you guys go about coaching that into your team?
It's definitely one of the toughest things that goes on in the G League. One thing we talk about is guys being a star in their role. So when we talk about those guys with the Mavs or even our guys playing alongside great players. Your job, first and foremost, is to play defense and make open shots. And after you successfully play defense and you're shooting the ball well, then you may get a little bit more leeway on the offensive end to go and make plays. But you have to kind of start in that role, doing your job perfectly, and then you gain trust from the coaching staff to do more things. And then, honestly, you have to show the guys that the way that they want to play, it just doesn't look good. And that comes down to conversations, comes down to film, watching some of our guys early in the season, basically just going one-on-one. And you kind of have to show those clips in film. And everybody knows at that level, these are smart guys. They know that that's not the way to play. So you just have to show how bad it looks on film. And then after that, you show the plays where we do move the ball. We get into the paint and there's a kick out, swing, one more pass. And then you have to kind of explain to those guys the percentage of your shots on one-on-one, highly contested shots is going to be much lower than when we play together and there's a couple of different passes, swings, and then you have a wide open shot. Your percentage will be higher and then you'll look better as a player.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the Portfolio Guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
How much time are you spending with players watching film? Obviously, you as a coaching staff and you as an individual, you're watching tons of film and breaking down your own games, and also I'm sure looking and scouting and looking at opponents. But when you sit down actually with a player or with your team, how much time are you spending per week with a player watching film?
Yep. So typically our team watches a post game edit after every game, and that basically includes offense and different categories about what we're doing wrong, how to get better, and the same goes for defense. Individually for a coach, we all kind of have our own position groups. Me being a bigger guy, I mostly have the fours and the fives. And when I go back and watch a game, I have to do points per possession for coach on the defensive end. I have to send coach my notes from the game. I have to clip edits and clips to send him as well. But then I go back and I watch film for the players. And when I watch film for the players, I'm basically clipping everything that I see that's good and that's bad. And this could be between 15 to maybe 30 clips. And then before the games, I'll kind of sit down with the guys and go through everything. So I would say if we play, you know, 2, 3, 4 games in the week, I'm basically taking maybe 20 to 25 minutes before each game to go through the players and kind of explain to them what's going on.
As you do that and you sit down with players and you're going through and looking at it, how much do you balance out what they're seeing when they're looking at their own personal clips? How much do you see of, hey, here's what you're doing right, here's some clips of you doing exactly what we're looking for, and then balancing that out with, hey, here's some clips of things that we need you to improve on or get better? Do you try to keep it balanced, or is it just kind of game to game? We just kind of see how things go.
There's a balancing act that goes along with this, because you can't show all bad and you can't show all good. In my opinion, also depends on where the player's headspace is at. If a player's really struggling, sometimes you may need to show more good than bad to kind of keep them on the right track. But it just kind of goes down to reading your player. In my opinion, I like to show a little bit of both, but that's kind of how it goes.
How much of your job is playing amateur psychologist with guys?
Honestly, it's every day. I mean, just thinking back to our last game against Sioux Falls, everybody on the staff is getting on one of our bigs about not calling out the coverages, and he's frustrated. He comes out the game, and I walk down the bench and I sit down next to the player, and I'm thinking of, you know, back to my playing days, and how do I explain to him what he needs to do better? And I sit down and I tell him, as a big on the floor, everything is your fault on the defensive end. And that's one thing you have to understand. There's no help. There's no talk. Everything is literally your fault because you're the biggest, the anchor of the defense in the last line of defense. And what I explained to him is you have to communicate loudly and effectively enough that everybody on the floor knows what's going on. And you also have to communicate loudly and effectively enough that everybody on the bench knows what's going on. So if you call out the pick and roll coverage that's soft and nobody can hear it, if something goes wrong and the guards don't get into the ball, that's on you. But if you, like our sideline pick and roll coverage is called ice. And if you call that ice loudly enough that everybody on the floor and everybody on the bench knows you called it, and then something goes wrong with that ice, it's not going to be on you. So there's a lot of kind of mind games you have to play with the player, and you have to kind of communicate with them on different levels.
Yeah, I know you talked about dividing up responsibilities amongst the staff when it comes to positionally, and you got a group that you work with, working with the big guys. Is there any other ways that you guys divide up in terms of responsibilities on the staff? Do you have a specific offensive defensive coordinator? I know there's some staffs that have that. Are there certain responsibilities that are designated for each coach? And if so, how do you guys go about putting that together and getting that organized?
Yeah, on the staff, we have one guy who has the offense, one assistant coach, and our head coach runs the defense. And then me and Nelson's job is kind of to assist with both. We also divide up different scouts. And there's a scouting schedule where, say, I have one scout, the next coach has another scout, and we kind of divvy it up that way so we're not kind of bombarded with scouts. That's probably the biggest thing is the scouting schedule is probably the thing, or scouts are probably the thing that takes the most time and the most tedious work with coaches. So it's good to kind of separate those so you have time to go in and do those scouts.
What's something that a coach who coaches at the college level or the high school level might not know or might not be aware of in terms of what it's like to coach in the G League? Or is there something that when you think back to your time as a coach at the college level, or you think about your dad as a high school coach, is there something about being a G League coach that maybe coaches at those other levels might not understand?
I think the toughest part about the G League is that everybody wants to get out.
Yeah.
Honestly, when you think about the players, coaches, trainers, front office, it's a level in the league where everybody wants to, you're obviously doing the work and appreciate the job, but everybody is trying to get to that next job. So it's about players, coaches, and staff being unselfish and really trying to work together. That's the biggest difference between the G League. I think in high school, everybody's kind of focused on that one common goal. You have some players who love the game and really want to play college basketball. And then you have other players that are just kind of happy to be on the team. So that's the biggest difference to me.
Do people talk about that? I mean, do you as a coaching staff, is that something that sort of just hangs in the background and nobody talks about? Or is that conversations that you sometimes have? Do you and Nelson ever sit down and be like, hey, what do you think's next? Or who can we talk to maybe get that next opportunity at the next level? Or do you kind of keep that on the back burner and just put your nose to the grindstone and do your work?
I think we talk about it, but I think the biggest thing that we talk about is continued development, not staying the same coach that you were, you know, a week ago. Or you just have to keep improving. And that goes for coaches, players, you know, front office. It's really about, and it used to be called the development league. We're all there to develop and get better. And then kind of after the season, you kind of go your separate ways and you see what happens.
All right. I want to ask you one final two-part question. So part one is, when you look ahead over the next year or two, what do you see as being your biggest challenge? And then the second part of the question is, when you think about what you get to do every day, working for the legends, working in basketball, being a coach, what brings you the most joy? So your biggest challenge and then your biggest joy.
The biggest challenge for me will be trying to balance working in the G League with a 6 or 7 month contract, as well as having a young family. I'm married with a kid that's almost two. So those are going to have to be some choices and decisions I have to make. And it kind of, you kind of really can't plan. You know what I mean? So, once April hits, my contract's going to be up. I'm not sure. I'm probably going to move back home like I normally do. And then you have to kind of look for that next job and then make sure that if you get that next job, it kind of aligns with the family. That's really the biggest, challenge for me.
And then your biggest joy?
The biggest joy is when you're working with a player and you're showing them film and you're working on things on the floor, and then that player executes something on the floor and they look at the bench at you and, you know, they point or something like that, or depending on what kind of player it is, they may yell. So it's just one of those things where it's great to work with the player, show them the film, and then they execute on the floor. And also, like I said, as an assistant, the thing that we put the most time into is our scouts. So putting the time into a scout where you're not sleeping and you're watching film and you're missing time with the family and you're getting up early and staying up late, and then you put together a good scouting report that the team can understand, and then the team goes out and executes the plan and you win the game. Those are the two joys I have.
Yeah, that's well said. I think it's something that any coach would appreciate and love when you see something that you conceive of in your mind, you watch it on film, you put it on paper, you share it, and then boom, it happens out on the floor. I know that's one of the most gratifying things that any coach can feel. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share how people can reach out to you, connect with you, whether you want to share social media, email, whatever you feel comfortable with. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
You guys can contact me. My email is camblack20@gmail.com. And you can also reach out to me on Instagram at underscore Cameron Black, CameronBlack.
Awesome. Cameron, cannot thank you enough for ending a long day of travel with us here on the Hoopheads pod. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.